see a radical reduction in the number of ministers. Not only do I think this will be a good thing in terms of devolution down to local government level, less meddling from the top, I think, will be mean more power for the bottom. But also it will give backbench MPs a lot more freedom, I think, to exercise their real right of scrutiny. I would also give select committees a lot more powers and make that an alternative route from ministerial office. In the States, you see politicians being able to build up a real sense that they are a defender of the public right, not because they gain high office in terms of getting to the top in a ministerial structure, but because they sit on at the head of a bill committee. And I think that we should try and make that a new career in politics so that people have respect for those who are not necessarily in the government, but who are still performing a very important function. I would also introduce proportional representation. I believe that the system that we've got into, whereby we squabble around a few marginal seats, which means that in the end all political parties hasten to the middle of politics, has not been necessarily helpful for politics in general. And I think that if we were to introduce some form of proportional representation in terms of reforming our electoral system, we might find that we have a more diversity, let's say, in those people who come forward and those people who can stand. And finally, I'd like to argue for a citizens' convention. At a time like this, where trust has been completely decimated in politics, I do think it's important for politicians to bring the public to the fore, not in the sense of open primaries, you know, let's just kick the bastards out, but actually sit people down with some of the very difficult discussions that we need to have. Democracy is not an easy thing. We shouldn't make it an easy thing. I think, you know, one of the issues with politics has been that, you know, everyone sort of tries to pretend to the public that debate and discussion is easy. You know, all of you will have a different view in here. And the idea that, you know, it's somehow easy to come to a consensus is just not true. So I would actually set up a citizens' convention, maybe of 150 people randomly selected, to look at, you know, what form of proportional representation we might want. Is it STV? Is it, you know, AV Plus, which was a system that Jenkins came up with many, many years ago? Or do we want to stay with the present system? What do we necessarily want to do with the House of Lords? Do we want them to be elected by region? Do we want them elected at all? I think that these questions, I think, given that politicians have failed to come to an answer over the last 12 years, rightly should belong with the public. And I think that once you involve the public in a sense of determining their democracy for themselves, I think that you'll end up with a kind of democratic settlement that is much more accepted by people, but also a realisation that while this is not Afghanistan, this is certainly not the sort of Britain that we need for the future. So I would suggest fully elected House of Lords, stronger select committees, citizens' convention and proportional representation as my way of reforming our democratic settlement.
Okay, thank you, Jessica.
Okay, Martin? I had the peculiar opportunity of being an independent member of Parliament for 4 years. I was elected in 1997 on an issue of public trust in public life, and look where we are now. You could say that I failed lamentably. But there's no reason we shouldn't keep at it. This is work in progress. And the book that I've just written, or which just wrote itself, actually had another title for it. I was going to call it Swindler's List. I don't have the same view of our elected representatives as Jessica does. I've been arguing for a long time, before the scandal revealed so much, that corruption in the House of Commons is not peculiar and exceptional, but widespread and endemic. And of course there are honest and hard-working and truly honourable MPs. But something like half the total of 646 are now in process of or about to hand back money they should never have claimed in the first place. One of the principles of public life is leadership. What kind of leadership is it where you argue with the fees office for the right of having a £2,200 corner seat in your second home? When you flip your homes, when you build up an entire portfolio of properties at the public expense, when you have the nerve to charge for hanging baskets and potted plants. Maybe this wouldn't have had the resonance it has, but for a time of recession. But I think it should have tremendous resonance anyway. When I'm with the military, and I spend a lot of time with soldiers, I have had all over the world a sense of being in the presence of the best of British. That is not the sense that I had in my 4 years as a Member of Parliament. And I served for 3.5 of those years on the Standards and Privileges Committee. So I saw what went wrong, and I saw how incapable the club is of regulating itself, because the members tend to take a very lenient view towards their own. There are two disgraceful episodes in my mind in public life in this country in the last 10 years. One was the hounding to death of a good public servant, Dr. David Kelly, and the other was the assisted departure of Elizabeth Filkin, the second Parliamentary Commissioner for Standards. And in the book I'm not promoting, I make the case that the peculation, the fraud, there's no other word for it, the corruption has grown much greater since she was let go in February 2002, because it sent a signal to all the MPs, well, fill your boots, boys, and even if you're complained against, you'll be okay. I also have a series of remedies, like Jessica. Some of them are the same as hers. Yes, there has to be electoral reform. There is a very strong case for the alternative vote, not AV plus with a little bias towards the political parties, just straight preferential voting. So the MP elected, it keeps the constituency link. The MP elected is the least unacceptable to the most people, which in an age of anti-politics is as good as you can get, I think. We need an end to Punch and Judy politics. I call it unclenching the fist. David Cameron has himself called for this, but he turns out to be rather good at punch and Judy politics, so he's kept at it. We need to loosen the power of the arthritic grip that the whips have on the windpipe of democracy. And next week there has, above all, to be an instant acceptance of all the recommendations of Kelly. There will be no sympathy with the foot dragging of MPs who say, well, we were just within the rules, because ask yourselves, who made the rules? They did. Who enforced the rules? The question before us this morning is reform or revolution. I think we need a little bit of both, and the revolutionary impulse brings reform. We haven't had a revolution since Oliver Cromwell and his speech in 1653 when he dissolved the Rum Parliament holds pretty well, I think. You know, ye mercenary wretches, ye have no more religion than my horse. Be gone. Well, we're going to have to, you know, we've been dancing with democracy since the Great Reform Act of 1832, and I think we've reached a point where we need to put certain, above all, we need to improve the calibre of our MPs, the actual quality of the individuals, to give them a chance, because we need MPs that we can be proud of. But well, there is a revolutionary sense in the air, but throughout this whole business, the only single act of violence has been one stone thrown through the office window of Julie Kirkbride's constituency Bromsgrove office. So I think that's greatly to our credit. But we have to keep at it. These people cannot regulate themselves. And where the miscreants have been allowed to stay in place, and not a single front bencher has been removed from the front bench, not one. Hazel Beers quit before she was pushed. Alan Duncan was demoted. They're all in place. Well, it's up to us, and I'm hopeful of a small band of elected independents in the next House of Commons as a beachhead of honest politics, setting an example to the others. And I, you know, the revolution is in progress, and it will bring reform. Smile at us, pay us, pass us, but do not quite forget that we are the people of England, and we have not spoken yet. We're going to have a chance to speak at the next election, and I'm convinced that we're going to do so. Thank you.
Thank you.
I've just realised I'm making my notes on the back of my speaker's expenses form. Please know that at 25 pence per mile for my travel costs, so it seems reasonably strict. I think by instinct I'm more inclined towards revolution than reform. So I'm now perhaps in a slightly uncomfortable position of potentially sounding far more conservative than the political reformers who you've just heard, because I on a very profound level want to defend Parliament, the principles of parliamentary sovereignty and democracy, against pretty much, I think, all of the proposed reforms that are being discussed and debated at the moment. I want to defend those principles of sovereignty and parliamentary democracy, because I think that I want to assert the possibility, distant as it might seem to us right now, that we could actually have a really meaningful, popular and legitimate system of politics. And I don't think the reforms that are being proposed will take us closer to that. I actually think, by and large, they will take us further away. I think we have to realise why people might be interested in politics in the first place. And historically, I think people get involved in politics insofar as politics is a means by which they can take greater control of their lives by having a greater say in the way that society is organised and run and where it goes in the future. That's the big thing that people are prepared to, have been historically prepared to fight for and struggle for and at times to die for, the capacity for greater self-determination, greater control over their lives. And I think, again, the historical gains won by Parliament and by a sovereign Parliament eventually through a whole long and etiated historical process. Parliament as a body which represents the people against the state, historically against feudal and aristocratic privilege and totalitarianism. These were, I think, the first steps towards the foundation of a properly democratic society in which we could all be represented and our will expressed as a means by which we could take greater control of our lives. And the reason that that principle of sovereignty is essential, as far as I'm concerned, is because Parliament is that forum in which our representatives sit, in which they do or should represent us, our interests, our will, our values and our conflicts, our contestations over what constitutes the good life and what kind of society we all want to live in. The members of Parliament are given their authority and legitimacy through popular election, through winning us over to support them in a particular understanding of where they should go and what they should be doing. And they sit there aware of the knowledge that that legitimacy that they've gained by winning us over to vote for them can be just as quickly and just as easily taken away at the ballot box. But for that reason, those members of Parliament are the highest representatives of our interest and our will, and they are a check, and any check upon their authority is ultimately, I think, a check upon our authority to determine what society looks like and how society should be organised. In other words, any check upon the power of members of Parliament is actually a check which comes from a source other than us, and it circumvents our authority and our legitimating function as citizens. I'll turn to some of the reforms and what I see as problematic with the proposed reforms in a second, but let me just first assert my revolutionary credentials, because I think there are certain kinds of more fundamental change that would be good and, in my view, quite straightforward. The first and most obvious change to the political system that we should do immediately, and I guess it's not controversial in this room of enlightened free thinkers, is to abolish the monarchy. That's a simple matter of principle. For as long as we are subjects and not citizens, for as long as we are subject to a hereditary authority, even if that is only in name, then we don't live in a democracy. That, I think, is straightforward. So let's get rid of her. Let's get rid of our dysfunctional family, and let's do it straight away. And I think Graham may have some more interesting and nuanced points to make about that than I do, so I'll leave that to him. Of course, abolishing the monarchy has a knock-on effect. One important point on which I agree with some of the previous speakers, by default, getting rid of executive privilege, getting rid of the capacity of the executive to act without the consultation of Parliament in certain very important issues. Think war as one obvious example. So, you know, it would be one means of redressing that imbalance of power. The second, perhaps slightly more controversial reform, shall I call it, or revolution, I don't know. But the second, slightly more controversial, but I think in the context of this discussion, perhaps more important change that I would want to make, is to get rid of the House of Lords. Not to reform it. Don't let's quibble about the proportion of elected and unelected, appointed, unappointed, hereditary, ageing, senile people who should be in there. Let's not quibble about these things. Get rid of it. The principle of having a division of parliamentary chambers is straightforward. It's a means by which the popular will expressed through our MPs is held in check. Insofar as that chamber is filled with hereditary peers, the popular will is held in check by the aristocracy, and we can probably all agree that's wrong. We're all agreed on that point. Insofar as the chamber is filled with appointed experts, the popular will is held in check by individuals who are deemed to be more enlightened than we humble, ignorant citizens, in order to make sure that we don't make the wrong kinds of decisions by supporting the wrong kinds of decisions or the wrong kinds of individuals making the wrong kinds of decisions in the lower chamber. And that will ensure that we don't do anything stupid with the way that society is run. And insofar as the second chamber is filled with directly elected individuals, all that we do is actually to divide the popular will against itself, to suggest that we need a chamber of differently elected individuals who can prevent or mediate or slow up the passage of our interests and the debate that's going on in that
first chamber slow up that in terms of how it passes into any form of legislation. Now, that's not to say, incidentally, that the House of Lords hasn't done some important things, as Jessica has suggested, some important things in terms of holding up very bad bits of legislation. I think in the arena of civil liberties, the House of Lords has been a fundamentally important check against the new Labour government. It's unfortunate that as undemocratic a body as the House of Lords is the only check that we have on civil to defend our civil liberties at the moment. I'd far rather that we had a more rigorous and fundamental lively discussion about the importance of freedoms going on in the lower chamber. The only chamber as I would have it. But unfortunately, these are not the kinds of... What does that mean? I've got a minute. Oh, bloody hell. Right. Unfortunately, these are not the kinds of changes that are actually being proposed at the moment. The kinds of ideas that are being put forward, I think, some of which you've heard being expressed, but there are lots of others that we might want to discuss, all involve, I think, primarily attempts to limit the sovereign power and the sovereign authority of our elected MPs in favour of more enlightened, more knowledgeable, more independent, more trustworthy, more experts... more expert, or by some account, more independent kinds of authorities. So in response to the expenses crisis, we've seen the growing importance of an unelected and unaccountable civil servant, Thomas Legg, to determine what expenses claims are legitimate and what are illegitimate. I think it's difficult to feel sorry for parliamentarians, or indeed to support their revolt against the retrospective introduction of fees legislation. There are so many things that it would have been good had they revolted over the last few years, that to think that the only thing that gets them livened and engaged is their own expenses is a bit sad and pathetic. But nonetheless, let's defend the principle, which is that Parliament, the body which is the highest authority in the land, which passes laws by which we are all bound, and which determines the course of politics, which scrutinises government, which holds the state to account, these are the jobs that Parliament can and should do. The idea that that Parliament can be subject to any external authority, be it independent experts, be it civil servants, or any other expert body of opinion, is, I think, profoundly undemocratic. I'll stop at that point return to some of my other points later, as a means of not answering your questions.
Thank you, Jim. Graham?
Yeah, thank you. I do think that the debate that has been going on since the expenses crisis has been dominated, unfortunately, by a lot of trivia and a lot of talk about tinkering around the edges and changing a few nuts and bolts here and there. And I hope that this debate does look seriously at the fundamental questions facing Britain's politics, and these are questions of power: who has it, how do they get it, in whose interests are they exercising it, and how can they be held accountable for it? Now, I do think that British politics is in crisis, but not because of the scandal of parliamentary expenses. This crisis goes much deeper and is in danger of worsening still. And I do believe that the expenses row, as James was saying, is threatening to add to that crisis in our politics and not bring about the reform that we need. And there is an element of a lynch mob mentality replacing serious political discourse. We are seeing serious debate about the reforms that we do need, being distracted by widespread ignorance of our political system and ignorance of basic principles of democracy. Now, we're seeing demands for bans on second jobs, banning the employment of family members, introduction of primaries and power of recall. And these are basically gimmicks that completely miss the seriousness of the crisis, which betray a fundamental misunderstanding of what representative politics is about, and which threaten to distract us from the real nature of the problem. Then I rush to punish those few greedy and corrupt MPs, and in the name of making our politicians more accountable, we seriously run the risk of making our politics less accessible to ordinary people and less accountable to the people. And in our bid to demand MPs higher standards, we risk stripping the meaning and purpose of politics from the political process, treating MPs as nothing more than civil servants, expected to clock in on time, abide by the rules and report back to their managers. And there are serious fundamental issues at stake which can be addressed by radical constitutional reform. And if you have a brief look at our constitution, we see that of all the institutions at the national level, only the people are only involved in one, and that's the Commons. The Lords has been successfully reformed backwards by several hundred years to when it was all appointed. The ever more powerful and centralised government is indirectly chosen through poorly run and infrequent elections. And as far as the head of state is concerned, we're told that is none of our business and none of our concern. And of all these institutions, it is the Commons which is in decline, and the expenses scandal is accelerating that decline. And no amount of tinkering around the edges, text voting primaries, celebrity candidates, will address the fundamental problems of our democracy faces. And we must face up to those fundamental problems, and we must face up to fundamental reform. We must return to the fundamental questions of power and democracy, and we must recraft our constitution as a republic, a nation governed for the people and by the people, a constitution based on popular sovereignty, not the sovereignty of the Crown, not the sovereignty of Parliament. Now, is it reform or revolutionary? Well, I think that's largely a matter of semantics. We certainly need to scrap the Crown, an institutional legal instrument that has kept power at the top and at the centre. We need a written constitution which does place limits on the power of government and Parliament, not detailing every nut and bolt of the system, but putting in plain English for all to read and understand answers to those questions. Who has power? In whose interest must they be using that power? How did they get there? And how do we get rid of them? And we could benefit too from a head of state who could play a role in the political process, act as arbitrator and referee, guardian of the constitution, and representative of a nation, able to speak on significant issues of the day. Not an Obama or a Bush, but a McAleese or a Robinson. A head of state who is accountable to the people, who can use some of the reserve powers the Queen has, but has no legitimate right to use. Our Queen is constitutionally pointless. She is essentially a puppet of the PM and a servant of the government, wedded to ideals and principles that belong in the Dark Ages, not to 21st century Britain. Now, there is a job to be done as head of state, and we must be able to choose who does that job and hold them to account for it. So is it reform or revolution? I would say it's revolutionary reform. And we need a new way of doing politics, a new understanding of the role of Parliament and politics and politicians, an understanding that Parliament is ours. MPs should be representatives of ordinary people, not public officials or civil servants. We need a new relationship between people and politicians, a new appreciation of politics as a battle of ideas, a contest between competing visions, not a beauty pageant between managers who are each claiming to be whiter than white and duller than dull. So we need a new vision of power, power not being gifted from on high, handed down to us from time to time by our benevolent masters, but power being delegated by us in a limited fashion to our servants, those who we freely elect to legislate and govern in our name. There's no reason to cling to established institutions, whether out of fear or nostalgia, if those institutions are not the best on offer. But it is time for genuine people's democracy, a new Commons with stronger power over the executive, fully elected upper house with full legislative powers, a written republican constitution that allows the people to have stronger control over the Parliament, and a new settlement for Britain. So we want a British politics that inspires aspiration, that engenders responsibility, that forces people to look at themselves as much as to politicians for the reason why politics is failing. A politics that repatriates that old cry, we the people. And that is the reform we need. It is perhaps revolutionary, it is ambitious, but it is very doable. An act of Parliament, a referendum, fresh elections, and a new start. So revolution, I believe, is the answer. It's a matter of what revolution we have.
Thank you very much. Okay, I've got a couple of questions I'd like to ask our panel before we come out to the floor. I mean, the first thing really, Jessica, Jim, Graham, you've all said, you know, parliamentary sovereignty is very important. This isn't the worst thing that's ever happened, but let's be honest, right? It has happened, and we do need to do something about it. So if you don't like the idea of external checks on Parliament, you know, what's your solution? I don't think it's perhaps fair to just kind of criticise the action that has taken place. And Martin, I'm a bit worried that you do kind of tar all MPs with the same brush. You know, I actually kind of sympathise a lot with Jessica's comment that they actually, you know, most MPs are in it for the love of politics, and they do really want to make the world a better place. And I think this scandal has done something to dirty the image of all politicians, perhaps unfairly. And the last question I'll just throw into the mix for you all to think about. You've all kind of talked about the technical solutions to the problem of the expenses scandal and our, you know, if you like, our democratic deficit more generally. But I almost think, what's the point of reform if we're not going to do anything with it? So we could have the best PR system, we could have a stronger select committee, we could have all these different things. But actually, you know, the point is that Parliament's there to do something. It's meant to be there so that people who want to change society are able to do that. But in the absence of any kind of political direction and any political will to change society, what's the point?
I'll
quickly start by correcting you. I've actually specifically said I don't want parliamentary sovereignty. I want popular sovereignty. I do think that there should be an external check on Parliament, and that check should be the people. I don't think it should be, as James was saying, it shouldn't be bodies of experts and the self-appointed great and good. I think that is an affront to the democratic spirit. But I think that the idea of popular sovereignty is that the people are in charge. Now, obviously, in a big society, we can't legislate collectively on everything. So therefore, we delegate power to a body of people who then do that job for us. But when you're delegating, you don't then say to those people, you can have all the power you could possibly want and also change the rules and put yourself in charge of us and all the rest of it. You just say, this is what we want you to do. There's limits to what you can do. If you want to change those limits, you come back to us and we'll negotiate it. And you do that on a national stage through referenda and through changing a written constitution. So, you have to allow Parliament to do its job. You have to give them sufficient power to govern and to legislate. But there have to be limits on that power. And those limits should be set out in fairly broad terms in the written constitution that can only be changed by the people. And I would say on the final point you're making about what do you do with politics, absolutely, I think that there needs to be a more vigorous sort of public debate about the changes that we need. I think the public debate is being stifled largely by the system. I think that the electoral system and the parliamentary system that we have forces politicians to race to the middle ground, to not scare people. Take my issue, for example. I campaign full-time on republicanism. There's 20% of the population out there who agree with me, at least. But politicians are terrified of speaking out on it. Even Lib Dems, even though there's more Republicans than there are Liberal Democrats. But, I mean, they're terrified of doing that because they're all racing to the middle ground. So we are robbed of that chance to have that serious public debate.
Okay, but do you really think it is the case that the ideological problems we have can just be reduced to technical hindrances? Because I think it's probably a bit wider than that, don't you?
Yeah, I think you need to have systematic institutional reform. But you need to, through doing that, you can encourage and engender a much greater sense of sort of public participation in political debate. And we need to have this idea, what I said about repatriating the idea of we the people, that is the idea that we need to have in this country, where the people really genuinely feel that they're in charge. And they're not going to do that if the system is always working against them, which it does now.
Okay. I think, Jessica, you wanted to come back.
Yeah, I wanted to come back because I think we're sort of missing the point of politics in this discussion, which can get very, very dry, because we're at a time where we need to really talk about institutions. People like me get involved in politics because... As you said, Susie, you want to change the world. I want to change the world in a specific direction. So I want people to be able to access healthcare free at the point of need. I want people who go through the education system to have every single opportunity available to them. I do not want people living in overcrowded housing because rich people don't want to pay as much tax as they do in this country. Now, I think that we're missing the point of politics and politicians, which is about ideology. And you can say that everyone's the same in the middle, and I said that too. It's true that in order to win elections in this country, you need to coalesce and not frighten people, because you have a system of swing voters who will say, oh, I don't want to be overtaxed, so I'm going to vote for the party who makes me feel that I'm not going to be overtaxed. And that's how New Labour came to power, and that's probably how Cameron will come to power next year, is by seeming to be particularly progressive, let's not frighten the horses. What we don't have in this country is a genuine debate about right or left, or the centre, or the far left, or the far right, and BNP has come to prominence precisely because I think we haven't had that serious debate about migration, about social housing, about the white working class, because it is just too difficult for politicians in the electoral system we have, I think, to have a genuine discussion that's very, very open. The second thing I want to say is, we the people is a wonderful concept. I love Thomas Paine. I've recently been to see that fantastic play at the Globe. America is based on that system, and they've had a wonderful election in Obama. But the fact is that hasn't actually massively changed their turnout. It hasn't made the public any more ideologically excited about politics. I think that you can get overexcited about abolishing the monarchy, written constitution, both the things I agree with. I do not think at this time those two things will suddenly lead to a massive revolution in our democracy. Actually, the problem we have is we don't have enough people turning out. We don't have enough people who even know anything about politics in this country or care. There are too many people in this country who are just actually happy with the system as it is. And that's why, actually, I would like a bit more revolution. And I think, Martin, you know, what you've done as a purveyor of decent politics is great. But you go to local government level, say Wales, where a lot of independents stand, and you know what? They are very corrupt. Because actually, they do not have a political party system to have a sense of values, a sense of, you know, what are we actually in politics for? And actually, I think a whole parliament of independents would be an absolute disaster, because it would take away what I think is very, very important, which is a challenge, a battle of ideas. I mean, this is the whole point. It is about, you know, how much more do we want to spend of our tax on healthcare or education or, you know, international development? Do we want to reorder society in a different way? Those are the sort of debates we should be having. And I think that, you know, while all of this reform is incredibly important, I don't think that we should reduce it to simply the we the people before we have that conversation with the people about what they want.
Okay, Jim, do you have any thoughts?
I mean, I'm worried that we might end up with a reformist sense, with what Graham's saying. You know, we need a written constitution. We may need a written constitution, I don't know, but I worry that we might end up writing a written constitution and getting rid of the monarchy without actually engaging people in a political process. And that, I think, is a really important point that's just been made. But the reason for that is because the reason that people are disengaged from politics, I don't think has anything to do with formal structures. I don't think it has much to do with the voting system. I don't think it has much to do with the expenses crisis. The expenses crisis, I think, was a very clear expression of people's mistrust and disdain for the political class, but it certainly wasn't a cause of anything. What we've had over the last couple of decades is a far more profound corrosion of political vision and political imagination, a closing down of the real ideological purchase of the ideas of left and right, of reform and revolution, an evacuation of the public sphere by the public, if you like, because the politics that's on offer, it doesn't galvanise them and doesn't inspire them. So it's not at all clear to me that a solution to that problem will come from elected politicians or Parliament. Certainly not at all clear that any kind of solution from that is going to come from making reforms within Parliament. What I'm suggesting in defending the idea of parliamentary sovereignty is actually an attempt to defend the role that we play in making decisions in our lives and the form through which we do that. And anything that, even on a formal level, limits our capacity to control Parliament and to control our elected MPs, I think is a problem, because it would take us further away from the possibility of having any further functioning democracy. I think the real difficulty that MPs have at the moment is that it's actually quite difficult, because they seem not particularly united by any engaging political project, certainly not within parties united by any coherent ideological project. Pretty difficult to imagine why anyone would be an MP at the moment, other than perhaps to line their own pockets. And that's the kind of mindset that you see being expressed in the expenses crisis discussion. I couldn't really give a toss about expenses, if I'm honest. I couldn't give stuffed into your pocket hobnob or a bath plug or whatever else is going on. I don't think that question of corruption is particularly interesting. I think it's interesting because there's very little going on that we might actually be interested in or engaged in terms of real politics. So what we end up with is an entirely managerial approach to politics, bookkeeping politics, accountancy politics. That, I don't think, is going to re-inspire the public in any way. And my concern, I guess, with what Martin suggests is precisely that we end up with, you know, as he says, the least unpopular candidate. You know, perhaps the best accountant or the best manager, perhaps the person who's squeaky clean, but not necessarily a person who actually has any kind of real political ideas or who's going to be able to actually win over and galvanise the public to support them on anything other than the fact that they will hold up their expenses sheet and say, look, I've filled it out and I haven't fiddled it. That is not going to transform or re-inspire democracy in this country.
Martin?
It's quite clear to me that your four panellists have come to this discussion from four different political planets. I'm rather grateful to the House of Lords. But for the House of Lords, we'd have 42 days custody without charge. But for the House of Lords, the Commons would have managed to exempt itself from the provisions of the Freedom of Information Act. I can think of no significant defence for dishonesty in our elected representatives. I'm not talking bath plugs and duck islands. We're talking phantom mortgages. One thing you do know if you get a mortgage, you know the day it ends. There has been widespread dishonesty, which in any other walk of life would have the police knocking on your door. The fundamental and tinkering around the edges, open primaries are not tinkering around the edges. Reform of the voting system is not tinkering around the edges. We are discussing serious and far-reaching reforms. The problem we have, I think, basically, is a growing gap between the government and the governed, between the politicians and the people, and I'm looking to the people to close that gap at the next election.
But is that, can I just ask, is that problem an institutional problem? Is it a problem of the form of institutions? Or is that gap actually not a far more profound social problem? So how will fiddling with the institutions address it?
I'm not talking about fiddling with institutions. I'm talking about widespread reform, which is going to lead to the kind of members of Parliament whom we can actually admire. And there are some of them out there, but not nearly enough. That's a start. And then you get on with your constitutional reform.
Just to push you on that, Martin, then Martin's book is really, really worth a read. And you know, you say in the book, and you've just said a moment ago, that you know you really do put, you know, people above everything else, and you see them as being, you know, the most important, you know, element of our democracy. But then I have to ask, well, you know, why are you so quick to put that check on them with the Independent Standards Authority? You know, you're happy for that check to take place, which is effectively a check on the sovereignty of the people. So how do you weigh that up?
I have the disadvantage, I think, of being the only person in the room who has been an MP and on the committee, and it's from my experience there that I have a profound understanding that MPs are incapable of regulating themselves. No other profession does. They all have outside regulators. Why should MPs alone be exempt themselves, because then they start doing what you've seen they've been doing?
The outside regulators of the democracy are the people.
Yeah.
If an MP commits fraud, then they ought to be arrested and prosecuted. If they've done something which is morally dubious but is not criminal, then the people ought to have the power to sack them at the next opportunity. Now, the idea that you then have self-appointed experts judging on this takes away the power of judgment of the people who have put those people in Parliament in the first place.
There's a funny dynamic, I think, going on in the claim for independence, and we see this claim for independence on all sorts of levels in politics at the moment. You know, this is not a political issue, this is not an ideological issue, whether it be questions of war or questions of the economy, we're independent. There's a general fear of political position taking. But I think in the expenses scandal in particular, what politicians are saying is, look, you don't trust us, you don't trust us to do anything. You're probably right not to trust us, because why would you trust any organisation that's self-regulating? So look, we'll get an independent in to regulate us. And rather than actually making anyone think, well, there's something more that they can be doing that might win our trust, what they're actually saying is, we'll get an independent in to regulate us to demonstrate to you that we don't think we're capable of regulating ourselves, so you are right not to trust us in the first place. It's a rather self-defeating kind of argument. Actually, trust is something that's won. It's not given to people because they're decent. It's given to people because they actually have something to say that might win people over, and that people might think, actually, this is someone who can take us somewhere, who's worth supporting.
OK, I'm going to have to stop our panellists there and come out to the floor. Like I said, you don't have to say who you are, because we do want you to say what you think. So can I see microphone and hands? There we go. OK. Can I take that gentleman at the back there?
Yeah, well, I want to sign up to this wonderful parliament that Martin Bell suggests, you know, one where, you know, people are sort of divorced from the party political structure. They're forced to go in and actually sort of, you know, discuss with each other, negotiate. You have a lot of independent MPs. You don't have the clenched fists so much. I think we have one in Brussels at the moment, in Strasbourg. It's the European Parliament, which seems to be very free of expenses scandals, and also has a great respect for the you know, democratic will of the people, apart from the French and the Dutch and the Irish. I mean, actually, you know, this, and that's the kind of nature of European politics. European politics, you know, nobody actually wants to have an argument in European politics. They want to do things behind closed doors. They want to avoid the clenched fist. They don't want the contestation. The problem is that we end up with a kind of situation where we have a profoundly undemocratic system. The European Union is one of the most undemocratic organisations on earth. I don't have to conjure up a mythical mob of what the alternatives are if we institutionalise the kind of anti-political, you know, reforms that you want. It's already there. And to be honest with you, you know, as we all thought when we signed the Lisbon Treaty, when we all voted for the Lisbon Treaty, when he had our great say on that, I'm not sure that that's how that's going to inspire me to politics. I don't think it's going to inspire many other people, and it's not something that I want to see for the way forward.
Yes, that's aimed at me. Can I answer it?
We'll take a few questions and then you can come back. Could you just pass the microphone forward to the gentleman in front of you with the poppy?
Thanks very much. It might be helpful to, when discussing the institutions of Parliament, which is what this, partly this debate is about, to actually look at what's happened to those individual elements and where the power lies. And if you actually look back at what's happened and the causes, then you'll see that it's the accretion of powers to the executive that is actually the cause of many of the problems. So the backbench MPs have been undermined because they've lost their power. The House of Lords has been undermined because it's lost its power because, more recently, Tony's cronies, more than independent people. You've then undermined the select committees because it's the whips who decide. So it's the party which is taking control, and the party is controlled by the executive. All the power has gone to, effectively, one man. That's the office of Prime Minister. Even the cabinet's been undermined. So if we start trying to unravel that by actually giving power back to where it's supposed to be, the House of Commons is supposed to have run itself, there'd be a lot more respect for the people if they had the power to do so. The select committee should have much more power. I agree with Jessica on that point. And you can go through the whole system. The politicisation, the accretion of power to the centre will show you, I think, where a lot of these problems have come from. So unwind that first would be one idea.
Okay, could I take this lady with the silver dress at the front here?
Hi, I just wonder, from what I've read, going back to kind of basic level, I don't really see why any of the parties in power are going to go for any of these changes. I think they sound great, and it seems like most people who read the papers and engage with these issues think it all sounds great, but I can't understand why any of the parties in power are actually going to go for any of them.
Okay, could you pass that to your lady?
Yeah, I found political lobbying very frustrating in the aftermath of the expenses scandal, because whenever you try to contact an MP, they always say, well, I'm afraid my whole office is currently engaged in photocopying my receipts and putting it online. And I'm not sure that this whole... whole experience is really beneficial, because I'm actually campaigning for things that I think are very important, people's liberties being taken away, and the fact that elected representatives are out of action is a grave problem, and probably more of concern to me than those receipts. I think that anything that breaks up the Labour v Tories myth is beneficial. Anything that encourages more independence, more independent parties, people saying what they think. I think that the other thing I find very frustrating lobbying is MPs saying, I agree with you, but I can't say that. And I think that a return of political conscience, of MPs just genuinely saying, this is what I believe, I stand or fall on these things, would be really, really great. More hustings, you know, fewer media opportunities, more hustings during an election, that kind of thing. I think also what would be really good is, I'm really suspicious of the I'm not that guy kind of thing, which we saw with Nick Griffin, everyone saying, I'm not Nick Griffin, and, you know, I'm not this other guy. And I think that that is almost like the least accountable form of political authority, because I think that, you know, while Martin, you very much have a point about some of the limitations, I think also I'd like to hear what your views are and you know, what you would stand for in a positive sense, I suppose, as well as cleaning it up. So, you know, what would the laws you'd bring through that would improve people's lives? So I think that while you know, that there is obviously a decadence of the state right now, I think also one of the worst things, a potential trap is that I'm not that guy sort of thing, because I think, well, what guy are you then? And stand or fall on that.
Okay, I'm going to come back to the panel quickly, and then we'll come back out for another round of questions. Can I start with you, Martin? Because
one of them was certainly aimed at me. I think I'm the only person here who ever stood for election to the European Parliament. I did it on an issue of honest politics and cleaning up corruption. I spent £640 of my own money. I got 93,000 votes, which wasn't quite enough, but it worked out at a penny a vote, and I'm glad I tried. And a lady wrote to me from Hertfordshire afterwards and said she didn't know I was standing till she saw my name on the ballot paper, and assuming I was an imposter, she voted for somebody else. This isn't something, the expenses scandal, that has been done to the MPs. It has been done by the MPs. They did it to themselves. And in failing to challenge the power of the executive, that also is something that they have done to themselves by wanting preferment, climbing the greasy pole, and doing what the whips tell them to do. So all these things hang together. As to what I stand for, I stand for honest politics. I believe that the small group of independents will be committed to challenging the power of the executive. It will demand equal representation on the committees. And I do not want a parliament of independence. The last time we had that was in the 18th century, and it was the most corrupt ever. What I want to see is more independent-minded MPs, more Lothian questions, more Tam Dyels, more Andrew McKinleys, more Betty Boothrides. Well, we're missing this element.
Okay, thank you. Do you want to come back on anything, Jim?
I guess just two things quickly. On the point about the executive, I think that's entirely true, but it doesn't strike me that the solution to that is a policy or a structural solution, by which I mean actually the absence of any kind of vibrant political debate, real contestation of ideas within the political sphere, expressed, I think, at the level of what's going on in Parliament, is the real problem. So the call for more independently minded people, I think, is a hugely important one. But I do also think that it's quite important that we ask independent of what? You know, because they may well be independent of Labour or Tory or even the far cleaner Liberal Democrats, you know, the far more honest Liberal Democrats. They may well be independent of all of those things. But the question of whether they're independent from us is, I think, the real problem. So we have, on the one hand, independent experts called in to make decisions over and above elected politicians. And on the other hand, we have people standing and saying, I'm essentially independent of politics. I'm independent of ideology. You know, this lady who recently appointed in the Tory party, whose name I now can't remember, she's made such an impression on my psyche. But she, you know, essentially stood by saying, you know, I don't know much about politics. Fantastic. It's just unfortunate that you're standing to be a politician, you know? That, I think, is the problem. A broad-based mistrust of politics, of being political. And ultimately that means independence from us and the conflicts that we have and the contestations of interest that we have in society that actually need to be expressed at a political level. That's my concern.
No, that's a really good point. I mean, I do think that the rise of independence is a you know, it's a mixed bag, because on the one hand you think, is this a rejection of collective politics, or is this an opportunity to more move towards new collective ideals? Jessica, do you have...
Yeah, I absolutely do. I mean, I think I agree with quite a bit of that. I think the name was Sarah Wollaston. She was elected in Totnes. I mean, I slightly feel as though we need to go through this kind of period of cleansing. I'm in favour of semi-open primaries, certainly not open primaries. I think open primaries could lead to exactly the opposite of what we need in politics, which would be people elected because they've got the most money, people because they've already got the most publicity, because they've already been on telly. You know, that's very, I mean, it's very, very easy for anyone who's been on telly to get elected, because it's just a name recognition. People don't need to think about what they're actually standing for. On the other hand, I do think that because it looks like right across the developing world and developed world that political parties just are not going to be bringing in new members, we do need to find ways of reaching out, and which is why I'm in favour of semi-open primaries where members get to choose the shortlist, but registered supporters of a party get to choose the actual candidate for a particular seat. Because I think what that could help to do is sort of politicise people at a very kind of soft level, ask them in to have a bit of a vote without actually asking them to pay the £40 to sign up. I think we need to have this process, and I think it will take maybe one or two general elections to get back to a point where people start to trust their politicians again. But I do think that we do need an independent regulator. I think it's absurd to say that somehow is a check on the public's ability. And the public has an ability to vote politicians in and out every 5 years under an electoral system that doesn't actually let them do that. But also, you know, really, are we expecting the public to sit down with the MPs' receipts in their homes and go, yep, that's it, that's actually according to the rules. Nope, that's not according to rules. I mean, I think it should all be on the internet.
I very much doubt the public would do that.
Well, right. Yeah, absolutely. So we do need to have somebody who sits outside of the Commons, okay, and actually says, yes, you have obeyed by the rules, and, you know, this is the kind of level of trust that we put in you. I just think it's absurd. You wouldn't, you do it with Ofcom, you do it with everything else. I think, for example, the Press Complaints Commission doesn't have an independent regulator, and it should do.
But the point is, Parliament is very different to all of the other businesses and institutions in society, because it's the one at the top in which we, our will, our interests are expressed. It's the ultimate decision-making body. It's the body that decides what society looks like. MPs are not managers of a company. the people who represent us. We put our trust in them to represent our interests, and we accept what they do or we get rid of them insofar as they do or don't represent our interests. So we shouldn't treat it like any other institution. We shouldn't pretend that it's any other institution. It's a very special kind of institution. And that's why I get worried when you say that, you know, what we want to do to re-inspire people is to say that, well, you know, come and have a soft approach to politics. We don't want you to sign down on the party line. We'll give you a gentle introduction, and that will be a way of, you know, gradually over time re-inspiring you in the process. I don't see that, because I think what you actually end up doing is saying, you know, politics is nothing very special, the running of the country is nothing very special, you know, so come and have an easy go. You know, don't.
Yeah, but
it's not
as if party politics and the punch and judo is necessarily appealed either, is it?
So, one of your objections is that, you know, the people don't have proper control over MPs, but people ought to have proper control over MPs. We do need a proper electoral system that does give people proper control and proper choice. And also, we need more frequent elections. 5 years is way too long to carry on in one parliament. You know, so you can give, and you can perhaps introduce power of recall. So, you know, you can still have expenses being made accountable. You can publish them in and so on, so that people can see what they are, and people will look. It doesn't need everybody to look; it just needs some people to look. And you know, and then you know that debate can be had in public, and the people can then decide whether they want to pursue that MP, you know, through recall or at the next election or what have you. Now, I do think that there is a slight danger with this whole talk about independence, and there's this idea that independents are, by definition, more honest than people that are joined up to parties, and I find that very odd assumption and not a particularly healthy one. And I do agree with, I think there's a comment earlier about the centralisation of power at the executive level. And I think that is one of the most fundamental problems that we have, and that does draw, you know, it does dilute the power of debate in Parliament. It does have a deadening effect on political debate generally in the country. You know, and I often say that, you know, British democracy is based on the notion of one man, one vote, and that one man is Gordon Brown. And, you know, as we had with the Lisbon Treaty, you know, he is the one person that decided that was going to be signed, and no one else got a say. You know, and I say that as someone who's pro-Euro, but, I mean, I still think that people should not be able to, you know, the Prime Minister should not be able to make fundamental decisions like that on his own. So I think that is absolutely fundamental to the problem. I do think that, you know, the institutions and the structures of politics do make a significant difference to the way in which public debate is had and the freedom in which it's had and the culture, the political culture that we can generate in this country.
Okay, can I see hands? Right, can I take... sorry, this gentleman at the front.
I mean, I'm a bit uneasy about the various proposals for reform, because I think that, you know, many of the complaints that existing structures make it hard to carry out political discussion, you know, the power of the whips, the sense that you can't say that, the fact that we have a few swing constituencies and so on, really misunderstand what it is that got us into this situation, because all those kind of political institutions and conventions which certainly feel outdated and don't really kind of correspond to the sort of world and politics that we have now were actually shaped by the last two centuries of intense political conflict and debate. You know, the party system, you know, very much designed to express conflicting social interests, you know, as is the whole of Parliament, you know, the two sides facing each other, confronting one another. And, you know, what we have now is a problem where, you know, all our political representatives, all our thinkers, ideologists more generally, have fallen back from trying to articulate a real struggle to take things forward. And so, you know, all these institutions appear somehow redundant, and, you know, all these politicians just look like they're in it for themselves. I think, you know, I mean, that's why, you know, as has been said, the expenses thing has touched a nerve, not because in itself it has any great significance, but just because, you know, there's no bigger ideology that people can be through which people's actions can be understood. And so in that sense, I think to focus on the institutions just gets the problem upside down. It's the lack of the driving ideological conflict that seems to have made all these institutions redundant. And the real danger is that we try to reform things in a direction of just, you know, accommodating to a very consensual system where we don't have a clash, where we institutionalise the idea that we just smooth things over, manage things, without providing the space for real conflict and the working out of conflict. So, you know, that's why, in a sense, I think, you know, we certainly can't say that the existing institutions are the problem. You know, if anything, they're from a previous era where there was more conflict rather than the present one, which lacks ideology.
Thank you. Could you go to that gentleman in the striped blue jumper, please?
Hi, I'd be interested to know Jason's thoughts on getting rid of the House of Lords in terms of its checks on power, for example, on, you know, the 42-day detention act and the Information Act, in the sense that if you got rid of this, the House of Commons, our democratically elected body, would have voted through these issues. So, and I completely agree that they shouldn't have done, but the fact was our democratic body was going to, you know, vote through these issues, and how would getting rid and placing such risk in the House of Commons be a good thing? Mm. I agree that we should do it, but it is such a risk, and I'd like to know his thoughts on that risk. Mm.
Okay, could you pass it forward to this lady?
Hi, I look forward to reading Swindler's List. The trouble with being an independent is getting enough people around to help fighting elections, not just the money. The elephant in the room is the EU. Stuff that comes out from that is debated in a quiet back committee room in secret, where the MPs elected kowtow to Brussels. So that's one serious point. I wouldn't want MPs to be paid more than $70,000 a year. They are not worth it. I would suggest better that they be tied to, say, five times a basic state pension, something like that. Every other expense to be verified, as would anybody who's self-employed. And finally, a minimum age of 35 should be able to get everybody to have some sort of experience of both politics and the real world, and the girls could get the babies out of the way.
Thanks. Could I take this gentleman in the red shirt over to the left? Yeah, maroon.
Evan Harris, I'm an independent-minded MP, I would say. I just wanted to offer three quick things. I mean, I think it's been said that the danger of the celebrity culture in Parliament may be just as bad as what we have at the moment. That in terms of open primaries and electoral reform, you can kill both birds with one stone with single transferable vote, which makes candidates from a single party compete for election with each other as well as with their opponents, and delivers proportionality and maximises voter choice. And that's overlooked, I think, by the Douglas Carswells of this world, who don't want proportionality. And the third point is the reform of Parliament. I was elected by my colleagues uniquely to a unique select committee on the reform of the House, coming out of the expenses scandal, in order to find ways of Parliament doing its job better in terms of holding the executive to account, which is a disgrace at the moment, what we are able to do. Government runs Parliament. It tells us what we can debate and when we can debate it. And even when Gordon Brown wanted to set up this committee, the government wouldn't give time for the House to debate it for a week, so we've had to do the work over the in a shortened time. And I was hoping Martin Bell would agree that whatever comes out of that committee, if it's reforming, people like him, with his reputation, have a key role in beefing up select committees, giving the control of the agenda and the timetable to the government to force the government to use its majority to defeat private members' bills, rather than have them talked out and not be able to be accountable for their decisions.
Okay, yep, if you just pass up.
Thank you very much. I thought when you came to We the People to speak, I was outraged this MP got in. reform or revolution? Well, I'm absolutely for revolution. I mean, who wouldn't be for revolution when confronted with this crock, this institutional crock that we're talking about today? But we're obviously not having revolution of the social and political character up to the barricades as we see it today. That's not going to happen. And that's not going to change the crock. Although I have to say, that's you know, light years more likely to happen, light years more likely to be effective than changing this through reform of strengthening select committees and having citizen conventions. I mean, that is pie in the sky, but it's worse than pie in the sky. It's quite dangerous. It's quite a dangerous proposition, and we should be very wary of that sort of talk. You see, it is about ideas and not institutions. And the old saying, the old cliche, we have the parliament and the people and the politicians up there that we deserve, we do. And, you know, the fish, they are rotten and it does stink, but the fish rots from the head. And the head, in political terms, in this situation, is the people. It is we, the people. You know, we do have the politicians that we deserve. And, you know, the revolution that is necessary is a revolution in the head. It's a revolution in the head of people. It's a revolution of ideas, a revolution in our expectations and aspirations, in our setting out a route of march, a direction in which we want to take society. You know, the existing, you know, political class is entirely exhausted. It's not just, you know, us that are powerless. You know, somebody said, oh, well, they got into power and then New Labour got into power and so on. They didn't get into power, you know, in any meaningful sense. They're cast adrift at the moment. As Tony Benn said, I got into power. It was office, not power, that I attained. Norman Lamont repeated that some years later. I got office, not power. And so, you know, we do have to look at it and we do have to reject. I mean, I hope I don't do Jessica a disservice, you know, but I don't think you're in the slightest bit interested in other than polishing up the sides of this crock in order to run it yourself in due course, you know, for a particular political party or other. You know, that's what's going on.
Okay.
I mean, but the revolution in the head is possible. It's happening here this weekend.
Okay.
It is achievable. We're doing it and we'll continue to do it. And it means we must look at the most radical. When we do have to engage with these, we have to engage with them. When we do have to engage with them, let's look at the most radical suggestions we've heard.
I'm going to have to stop you. Thanks. Can I see how many hands I have up? Okay, could you just take the gentleman right at the back, please? We'll come back to the panel after.
Hi. Thank you. I just wanted to say something about the monarchy. The fact is that the monarchy...
Can you speak into the microphone?
Sorry. I just want to talk about the monarchy. The fact remains, the monarchy is very important for Britain because it's a symbol for it. You know, what we don't realise is outside the UK, you know, people identify Britain from the monarchy. That's, you know, our symbol. Like it or not, this is the thing that attracts people towards Britain. I don't know. You know, I do find it important to take care of them. I know they're not the best bunch of people, and they are quite annoying sometimes, but they are important because they have a symbol and, you know, no company will get rid of it.
The international symbol of Britain is an old lady in a tiara.
Well, what, you know, the pound has the Queen's head face, doesn't it? So,
thank you. We are running out of time, so we're going to come back to the panel for their thoughts on those questions and come out for one final round. So if you do have your questions, get them ready. Do you want to start, Jessica?
Yes, I just want to say, there are a couple of things I want to say, but obviously to the gentleman who challenged me on why I'm interested in politics. I'm actually standing as a council candidate for the council elections in London next year. And I think there is a real problem, and you're right. We do need a revolution in the head. But also, I'd like to challenge your cynicism, because actually you get people who only want to get into politics for the power, because anyone who ever thinks about it for the right reasons gets the cynicism to come back, and they just go, actually, I want to do a job where people see me and trust me and like me and don't question my motives. I'll go work for a charity, or I'll work for an NGO that's trying to, you know, tackle climate change, because actually at the end of the day I get up in the morning and I go and do a nice job and I go back home and everything's okay. Politicians actually at the end of the day, as I said at the beginning, I think most of them do go into politics for the right reasons, not just because they want to get power, but because they actually want to do something with the trappings of power to change people's lives. And I've seen politicians day in day out do that for their constituents, you know, people who stop people getting deported for the wrong reasons, people who actually do get, you know, somebody a council house that they've been waiting for many, many years, because they just put in, you know, the time, the effort to actually ensure that the bureaucracy works well. Now, that doesn't sound, you know, like the right reasons, but it is actually at the end of the day, it's actually performing a service for people when you've got a position of power. So I think slightly challenge your own cynicism, otherwise, you know, we're not going to get the kind of politicians that we need. Second thing you said was you're wary of citizens' conventions and you think it's pie in the sky and dangerous. Well, I don't think it's pie in the sky. There's a bill going through at the moment. All it takes actually would be for the government of the day, the party that I believe in, to support that bill and actually would be able to put that into process. It's not pie in the sky. It's absolutely achievable. The other thing, the lady said that, that people kowtow to Brussels. I'm actually a great sort of fan of Europe. I don't think it works very well. It's difficult to know how you make an organisation that is so high work for so many people who are very much at the bottom. I think we need to completely reform the institutions of the European Parliament, but I don't think this is an easy question. But also, a minimum age of 35. I mean, if you want representative politics, how can you have a whole swathe of people from the age of 16 to 35 completely unrepresented in your parliament? And then the idea of, you know, it lets the girls get the babies out of the way. What to do with, what, you know, what about men? I mean, men have a responsibility also to bring up children, so maybe they shouldn't get into parliament until they've got the babies out of the way as well in that case.
Okay. Graham,
do you want to say that? I ought to address the monarchy bit very, very quickly. But, I mean, firstly, I've travelled extensively around the world, and the only things that people ever raised with me are football and cricket. So that's a good argument for putting David Beckham into Buckingham Palace. But, I think we need to look at serious constitutional structural issues rather than, you know, some 19th century sense of identity. The power of the executive is fundamentally important, and I do think that the number 10 essentially is like a black hole. It does suck ideas in, it sucks power in, it has a huge dragging effect on the whole political system. The power of patronage, the power of the whips, it does deaden the power of Parliament. The question was raised about the House of Lords, and it's been suggested that the House of Lords played a fundamental role in stopping our elected politicians from doing what they wanted to do. But the elected politicians weren't doing what they wanted to do. They were doing what they were being told to do by the executive. And so if you can have fundamental constitutional reform in the Commons, then the House of Lords is less of an issue in that sense. But I think that we ought to have a fully elected house, upper house, in the same way that Australia does, and that works pretty well. The issue about paying MPs less is what I was kind of getting at the beginning about, you know, this kind of witch hunt mob mentality that is going on about in the wake of the expenses scandal. Because that would be far more damaging if we started putting limits on MPs' pay. Because in the same with this issue of some of these other issues that are being proposed at the moment to do with, you know, limiting expense claims and so on, because you are running the serious risk of Parliament being only open to the rich. And that is very, very damaging. People have to be able to get elected and then support themselves in Parliament throughout that term in office. And you cannot simply allow the millionaires to get in. Minimum age, absolutely not. We need to be able to allow people to elect people they choose. If the people want a 19-year-old MP, then that's who they'll get. If they don't, then they won't. Simple as that. And I do think that primaries, again, is a distraction from the real constitutional reform that we need. And I can't really understand the point of primaries. As I completely agree with what Evan said, that, you know, STV is the answer. Open primaries, I don't really get the point of asking constituents to first vote on the people they're going to vote on and then vote on those people. I just can't see the point in it. Why not just vote on those people right from the start? So, you know, I do think that, you know, we, as I come back again, institutional reform is fundamentally important. It will change the way the power is operated.
I mean, the open primaries thing is quite interesting. In the Sunday Times last week, there was an article. A guy that was a runner-up in Big Brother last year is now running to be the MP in Glasgow North, and he says he's got no policies whatsoever. He'll just, you know, say what he thinks as and when. But I think that kind of encapsulates the problem with open primaries, which is actually, like Sarah Wollaston, you're going to get these individuals going in on personality rather than any kind of political conviction. You don't really know what you're voting for.
Well, this is
for.
The thing with the independent. Someone along here said, you know, asking Martin about this. I mean, if you're standing as an independent, that's fine. But, OK, I mean, you're standing as an honest, honesty candidate, whatever it is, clean politics and so on. But when you're in Parliament, what are you going to do on health? What are you going to do on education? What are you going to do on war? What are you going to do on, you know, foreign affairs? These are fundamentally important issues, and we need to know what people are going to do on those rather than simply claiming that they are clean skin and are going to be, you know, filling out their forms properly.
Okay, Jim?
Well, I was just thinking, I like the idea of a revolution in the head. We could perhaps have a vote right at the end to see which of us has the most revolting head. That might be a way of taking this argument forward. Just one point, I mean, in terms of your question about Lords, I think you're absolutely right. In the absence of the House of Lords, we wouldn't have got a check on a number of potentially disastrous restrictions of our liberties. The difficulty is, and as someone who, you know, campaigns around the issue of civil liberties, campaigned against 42-day detention, I got slightly excited when Davis stood down on his libertarian platform to say, you know, we need more libertarian debate in Parliament, and he said, you know, we can't have 42 days. 28, that's fine. We'll go for 28. And at that point, my excitement kind of disappeared, you know, and I thought we're not going to have a serious debate in Parliament. So that might lead you to think we need the Lords because they're more sensible. I think the difficulty is that democracy is a profoundly messy business and involves us actually winning some arguments. There wasn't any kind of real debate, I think, about the freedom issue in relation to, you know, let's focus on this one, detention without trial. There was a lot of debate about the technicalities of how many days do you need? You know, how much freedom do you want? This much or that much? You know, 28, 42, 14, where are we going here? No real debate about the real substance. And that's the kind of discussion that we need. What's worth pointing out, though, is that, you know, 42 days wasn't brought in off the back of any great popular outpouring or any great popular demand or claim. The difficulty that we have with Parliament at the moment is that it's entirely distanced from any expression of popular will. So in order to get rid of the House of Lords as an anti-democratic body, what we need is a more democratic Parliament, and that requires it to engage with us far more.
Thank you, Martin.
It's a particular pleasure to welcome Evan here. If all the MPs were like Evan, we wouldn't have an expensive scandal. If all the MPs were like Evan, we wouldn't have gone off to an illegal and disastrous war in Iraq. It was our main parties that did this and their whipping system. We do have a problem with kids in Parliament. It's not the youth, it's the inexperience. They go from one set of cloisters in Oxford and Cambridge to another in the Palace of Westminster, and they've got no real life experience. As for the monarchy issue, yeah, let's have a referendum by all means, and we can live with the result of that referendum for 10 years, and we'll have another one. And for my lifetime and yours, we're going to keep our monarchy, I'm pretty sure.
Okay, can I see a final show of hands? I'm really sorry, but we're going to have to be quite quick with the questions. Can I take... I can't see me going back. This gentleman here.
Quickly on what the gentleman just said, Martin. What does real-life experience encapsulate? Going abroad, working for some charity, or working in Tesco's and actually... knowing how the lower social classes strive for better living standards. And also about the inefficiency of Parliament as the main institutional body for governance. I'd like to know what the panel has to say about the nature of politics in itself in our contemporary society in terms of the managerial way in which politics itself is conducted and the introduction of perhaps a market's logic in the administration of policy, whether it be at the ministerial level or the council level, where any moral controversies more or less emptied out of politics and targets and numbers are what necessarily public administrators seek to target.
Okay, and this gentleman at the front.
Jim came towards it at the end, but I think it's important. We've talked both about generating more excitement in the public about ideas and sort of helping them to form a kind of public will or understand political issues. And we've also talked about institutional tinkering or reform. And what it seems to me is the crucial bits in the middle, it's actually linking those two things. So actually what we should be doing with our parliament when we're reforming it is saying, how do we best represent the will of the people? And that will, we have to understand, is a complex being in itself. It's not something that is singular. It's not something that is even fixed or decided in advance by people when they go to the polls. What we need to understand is that people can change their ideas when they're presented with facts that matter and information that they don't otherwise have access to. And that the nature of political debate that goes on in Parliament has a reflexive effect on the debates that happen in the country in a more representative system. And that the whole political arena should be a huge feedback loop. And we should understand that you can't deal with one or the other. You have to deal with the transmission between the two.
Okay, are there any further questions? I mean, I have two that I'd like to throw in just before you sum up. I mean, the first, we've heard a lot about parliamentary sovereignty, but I just kind of think, you know, why should we be the ones to defend parliamentary sovereignty if our own MPs won't? I mean, a few points have been made already from the floor that, well, actually, you know, we all want this, these kinds of changes. And, you know, the MPs aren't standing for it. They're meant to be representing us. And, in fact, a lot of the time, they're representing things that would be beneficial to them professionally. So, you know, why should we take that on? And the second thing I wanted to bring up, which has also kind of trickled through this discussion today, is the idea of conflict in politics. I know Martin is keen on the idea of consensual politics. He doesn't like the conflict, whereas I think Jessica and Jim certainly have both talked about the need for more contestation, about the fact that politics is about changing the world, and that's obviously going to mean having a lot of tough arguments and disagreements. So I'd quite like to hear your thoughts on that. So in reversing order, if we could sum up.
I think what you've said down the front here is eminently sensible. It does need to be, democracy is a process. It's not a simple set of events where you just elect some people and then have a series of debates and votes in Parliament and then elect more people. It is a constant process. It does have to have that element of feedback loop. People need to have ways in to participate into the process between elections and so on. It is a very messy and difficult process, and that's, I think people just have to live with that and not keep looking for some kind of perfection. I think the fundamental point here is that we need to sort of tip the whole way that we think about power upside down and think, you know, we ought to be the ones who have all the power at the beginning, and what are we going to give to the people who are going to do the legislating and governing? And we look at it that way when we're reforming Parliament, and I think we will have much stronger checks on the executive. I haven't defended parliamentary sovereignty, as I said, and I think it needs to be popular sovereignty, and I think that, I do think that MPs do need to shoulder a lot of the blame for what's been going on. I completely agree it's not just institutional, it is down to the MPs not doing their job properly, but as I said, there is significant power at the top which is being exerted over them. On the consensus politics, I am in favour of consensus politics, but I do think that there needs to be a contest and a competition in that consensus. So in other words, when I talk about consensus politics, it's about not allowing one side to win everything that they want. So in other words, you have you don't have a parliament that just does the bidding of the government. You have a parliament that genuinely debates. It is separated into parties, none of which have a majority, so that you then have to build some kind of consensus. Obviously, there will always be winners and losers, but you still, within that process, need to have that very strong, competitive battle of ideas.
Thank you. Jim?
One of the most interesting and important points I think was made at the front earlier, far more eloquently than I could have made it, which is the danger that we have at the moment of potentially reforming Parliament around an absence of politics and accommodating to a situation in which politics is dull, lacking ideas and lacking any kind of vision. That, I think, is why I'm dubious about both the reforms, the reforming agenda that I profoundly disagree with, which serves to introduce independent authorities over MPs, but also why I'm slightly dubious about the idea that the way we solve the problem is by writing down a constitution, as if we could get a bunch of academics together to come up with a constitution and then get the people inspired by the process. I'm nervous about both of those ideas. How do we connect politics to people and vice versa? Much as I want to defend parliamentary sovereignty as an expression of the sovereignty of the people. In other words, I want to defend the fact that there is no authority over those members of Parliament other than us. I think the fact that MPs won't do it for themselves, which has been largely true, is perhaps an expression of the problem of formal politics as it exists at the moment, and the dearth of any kind of real ideas or indeed
real representative function in formal politics as it exists at the moment. And I suppose that leaves me thinking we need to demand a bit more of our politicians, but it's also the case that we perhaps need not to be too naive and expect that by changing Parliament or by changing the way our elected MPs do things, that will sort the problem. Actually, there are lots of issues that we actually, I think, need to take up for ourselves, making demands of them, perhaps standing in opposition to them, forming our own and attempting to galvanise our own political projects. And that's actually something that I think we need to do quite urgently. That's the way that politics will be transformed, that Parliament will become more accountable because we demand its accountability to us. And potentially that in that process we might be able to win people over to a more certainly divisive, conflictive politics through which we could actually start negotiating how we want society to be run.
Thank you, Jim. And Martin?
The idea that what we need is more conflict and division and battle of ideas. I've spent it all my life around conflicts and divisions and battles. We want to agree with each other. We want to improve things. We need to work together. It isn't their parliament. It isn't even Evans' parliament. It's actually our parliament. And I think we can do it. But just to sort of have phony arguments with each other, I don't think really gets us there. Look, let's understand. There's no New Jerusalem. There's no shining city on the hill. Our MPs, at least half of them, have disgraced themselves and disgraced each other. And it is for us to apply the remedy at the ballot box.
I guess what I'd like to say is just paint a picture of a future that we could have and the future that I don't think we should have. We can have a future where every vote counts through a reformed electoral system. We can have a future where public actually put forward constitutional change through a citizens' convention. We can have a future where we have a reformed elected upper house. Or we can have a future where the mob takes control through open primaries, elect celebrities with a lot of money, where we don't have any discussion in politics, that people come with their own agendas without any sense of what they want to do when they get into Parliament. I think that at the end of the day, it's up to us, the people. There's been a lot of talk about the people, but we're the ones that are meant to be fighting on climate change, against poverty, against maternal mortality in third world countries. It's only if we put these issues on the politicians' plates that we will get the kind of politicians that we want in Parliament. So let's not just concentrate all on constitutional reform or Parliament itself. It's up to us, I think, at the end of the day.
OK, can we thank our panel, please?